Blog Talk Radio.
We are the heirs of that first revolution.
Will a strong and united America still be a force for freedom and prosperity around the world?
America has created the longest peacetime economic expansion in our history.
We are the heirs of that first revolution.
Good common sense and sound judgment of the American people. And their essential love of justice.
Good evening. It's Sunday, April 21st. It's time once again for the Kudzu Vine. We thank you all for tuning in with us tonight. We have a great show lined up for you. More on that in a moment. First of all, though, I'd like to say hello to Catherine Smith. Hey, Catherine.
Hey, greetings from Atlanta. Happy Easter and Passover or whatever spring holiday you might be celebrating this weekend. I hope it brings you all comfort and love of family and peace.
And amen to that. And I'm Tim Shiflett coming to you folks from just across the road from Lookout Mountain, right up here on the Alabama line on the Georgia side. Now, if you're listening to me talk instead of David, and you've heard the show before, you already know that David is not going to be able to be with us tonight. Some urgent family matters came up, and David, if you're listening to us, we hope that everything is okay in that regard, and we're thinking about you, buddy. That being said, in just a few minutes, Matthew Dowd of ABC News will be joining us. We certainly look forward to that. We certainly have plenty to talk to Mr. Dowd about this evening. But in the meantime, we're going to plug ahead with some political news, and there was a bunch of it. Of course, the Mueller report, everybody out there listening knows, is the dominant story. We're going to talk about that tonight, both with Matt Dowd and at the end of the show. But first, we're going to move on to some other major political happenings, and there are some. And I guess we want to start with the state of the Democratic field. Finally, Joe Biden is slated to announce on Wednesday in a video that he is in the race. The field now grows to 19. Catherine, what happens when Joe gets in? His polling numbers go up, down? Where do you think we're at?
I think his polling numbers will probably stay even for a while, but I'm not so sure that they're going to remain high. I was on the morning shows this morning. They were talking about front runners in elections past, and they don't always turn out well for the front runner. So it'll be interesting to see how that, you know, what happens and how he and Bernie's numbers, whether they change, whether they go up or down or stay the same, or and then. Beyond that, if they do go down, who fills in that void? And I think it's going to be interesting. I mean, with 20 candidates, and let's hope that the door shuts behind Joe Biden. Like, can we just stop with everybody joining in? So it's going to be interesting. What do you think is going to happen?
Well, let's see. The latest polling, and I will turn to Real Clear Politics because they do aggregate polling, polls of polls. A lot of big names like Charlie Cook turned to them, so we're certainly going to do that ourselves. They have Biden at 30, Sanders at 22.5, O'Rourke at 8.8. Harris at 8.5, Buttigieg at 6, even Warren at 6, even Booker at 3, 8.5. Now, the other 12 candidates in the race are all below 2%. I don't think anything is impossible right now. It's not what I'm getting at, although for some, it probably seems improbable. And when we look at this field, we see that the top two in the polls on the Democratic side are the two oldest candidates in the race. One is 76, the other is 77. Of course, we know that the president is also in his 70s. Four of the top five in the polling are male. What does that say, Catherine? Is it just name recognition that has propelled some of the names I called to the top of the polls right now, or is it something else?
I think a lot of it is name recognition. I also think that money in the bank always helps, and those candidates have money in the bank, so that helps. And I think there's some, I think some Democrats and, you know, independent voters have some extra confidence in someone like Joe Biden because he has a lot of experience. We all know that can work for in your favor, or it can work against you. You have a lot of votes that you have to answer to, and a lot of statements that you've made over the years that can come back and haunt you. They can also help you and propel you. And I think that's going to be the case with Bernie and with Joe Biden. So I think those are the but I think that's also one of the hard parts of this campaign, this primary and general election, is going to be how the candidates stake out ground on policy while still fighting against the Trump presidency. I think Trump is going to be a big topic of the presidency, but we can't, you know, I always say you can't just run against something. You have to run for something. And so I think it's going to be a balancing act for these candidates to stand up for the values that they want to and the policies and the programs and the future, the vision that they have for our country, as well as criticize and denounce the Trump presidency. And I think it's going to be.
Yeah, well, you mentioned something, and I want to throw this question to you so you can expound on it a little bit. Seems like next year, more than a lot of recent years, policy is kind of taking a back seat, and it's being replaced with who can be. Do you think that Democratic voters are making a mistake in looking for that man or woman on a white horse to roll over the evil Trump?
I do, because I think, you know, you and I have talked about this offline before. I think that we have to engage our Democratic voters who are spotty voters, who sometimes vote, sometimes don't, who don't feel like there's leadership in either party that represents them. And, I mean, I think it's a little more difficult to say that this time because Trump doesn't really represent anyone but a very small portion, really. But I think that in order for people to get excited about a candidate and excited about an election, you have to do more. Like I said, you have to do more than run against something. You have to talk about the values and the concerns that they have, whether it's healthcare, which is going to be very important, economic equality and, you know, minimum wage and you know, all the things that go into economic justice, and then also some of the social issues, whether it's abortion or gun control or and like I said, it's going to be a really fine line to be walking to be able to reach out to those voters who are who feel disenfranchised because, you know, some white guy has been telling them what to do forever, but also keep our anti-Trump voters. So I think we have a challenge ahead of us. I don't think it's going to be easy. Everyone seems to think that it's going to be all about Trump, but I just don't think we can look at it that way. We have to be more than that.
Mm-hmm. You know, a lot of thoughts I've had on this that could make this thing swing wildly, if you will, in several directions. Number one, I believe if the campaign is about issues, that we'll win. I believe that we are where the American people are on most issues, certainly on economic possibilities for the middle class, certainly on things like Social Security, protecting that, Medicare, Medicaid, and Medicaid expansion, things like the Affordable Care Act, instead of ending it, taking it and making it better. I do think the American people want to have a serious discussion on immigration, not this build a wall, the wall just got 10 feet higher, Mexico's going to, absurd nonsense. I do not think the American people want to see kids on television being ripped apart from their parents and put into cages. I do not think that the American people want to see refugees described as animals. I believe we have a lot of winning issues right there. All that being said, there's going to be some other things come up too. Obviously, the age of the candidates is probably going to be something of an issue. Sometimes you have youth against age in campaigns. Like in 1992, Bill Clinton, Al Gore, they call them the young guns, you know, running against a tired establishment figure. And it helped propel, you know, President Clinton to victory. We had this new energy that young people just latched on to 11 years ago when Barack Obama came on the scene, a fresh face full of hope, again running against an older establishment figure. And now we have the possibility that two septuagenarians could be the nominees of the party. I'm not saying that's a good thing. I'm not saying that's a bad thing. I am saying it's probably going to be a thing. It's probably going to be something that people talk about as we move toward the nominating process in this party. Age will have to be a part of it. Don't you agree with that, by the way, Catherine? That the age of the candidates
I think the age of the candidates is going to be, it probably won't be, it's going to be hard because people will say, well, it shouldn't matter how old they are if they're capable. And, you know, I tend to agree with that. I'm old, so I like to think that I'm capable of things. I know I'm not capable of being president, but, but also, I think that the way to mitigate that, if we do end up there, is by having a younger running mate who is capable and clearly shares a vision with both the candidate and with Democratic voters so that they feel comfortable they would feel comfortable if that person did have to become president because of something. But mm-hmm. I've said this before. President Obama was the first president I voted for who was younger than me when he ran. And I have to say, I really mm-hmm. liked that. And I'd like to do it again. I'd like to see someone, under 60 be our president. I think that gives them a better chance of being a two-term president. And I think it can appeal to a younger voter group, a younger demographic. Mm-hmm. So, but I don't like to talk just about age, because it's not just age. It's also vision
that's
ability
true.
And stamina and all those things. So,
yeah. I mean, for instance, we know that 54% the citizenry and about that same amount of the registered voters are female in this country. We have a lot of female candidates in the race. That has to enter the picture. We know that persons of color are well represented in this race. That also will have to enter the picture, as, for instance, African Americans are among our most loyal voters. Not that we appease them by naming one of their own, as one of the people running for president, but still it's something that's going to play itself out in the process as that process goes along. Another thing that's going to play itself out in this process, and one that may be a bit worrisome to us, is something that you alluded to, Catherine, in your opening remarks, and that is the sheer amount of people that are running. Now, the Republicans had this big field in 2016, and to their horror, they watched as establishment candidates divided up the vote, and Donald Trump kept winning primaries with 30, 35, 40% of the vote. Until by the time it was down to just Trump against one or two other people, the process was already over. Is there that danger in our own nominating process this year for the Democrats that we could run into something like that and end up with a less than desirable nominee? Now let me preface that by saying, or let me add to that by saying that I think any of the 19 people running right now are like, 10,000 times better than Donald Trump, but still, don't we run the danger of not getting a nominee that, say, two-thirds of our voters would even care to vote for in the general election if this goes along like the Republicans did?
Well, I can only say, I would hate for that to happen. My one comment about that is I am optimistic that none of our candidates will be as hateful and critical and bullying to their fellow primary running opponents as Donald Trump was to his opponents in the 2016 election. Remember mm-hmm. all the nicknames he had for everybody and just the mm-hmm. very, crass and unpleasant way that he behaved during the debates. And then also whenever mm-hmm. he was given a microphone, which seemed to be altogether too often.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm hopeful that we don't have that kind of tenor in our primaries. I mean, it's fine to be, to rattle some cages but hopefully they won't be talking smack about each other like Donald Trump did, because that really,
mm-hmm.
Really poisoned the pond, I think. I mean, it made those who were, you know, hopeful to be, you know, part of the Republican Party and, you know, hold some, you know, kind of, I mean, I think it made people, made them cower. So they weren't, they couldn't stand up to him as he gained in primary states. Nobody stood up to him. So I'm hoping that we don't have that. I'm crossing fingers and toes that we do not have that kind of nastiness in our primary.
Mm-hmm. Another thing that we had happen, you know, 3 years ago that I certainly hope does not happen next year is that about 10% of Sanders voters actually ended up voting for Trump because they found, you know, that Hillary Clinton was just totally unpalatable. They did believe the stuff put out by WikiLeaks and others that it was stolen, you know, from him. And they wanted to send a message. Do you think there is any danger of something like that happening again next year if a certain Democratic candidate does not get the nomination who has, shall we say, devoted followers? I'm hoping that that don't happen. But do you see something like that happening again?
I certainly think there's already some sort of gurgling up of some of that kind of stuff happening already. And, you know, we're very early in. But I think the leadership of, like, the ultimately the leadership of the candidates is what people will look to. So they're our candidates are going to have to unify around whoever we choose. And I just cannot emphasize enough. I mean, I've never really been one of those people who says, you know, this is the most important election of our lifetimes, because I've always believed that every election is equally important, whether it's school board, city council, state legislature, or president. I think they're all really important. But this one, I worry about the sort of the zeitgeist of our country if we reelect Donald Trump. I just feel like it will send a message not just around the country but around the world that we have lost our bearings as as the United States of America. And that's not something that I'm willing to. I think we have to recognize that there are very serious a very serious future ahead of us, and we have to be very deliberate about what we do in 2020 to make sure that we remain the country that we are.
I want to return to normal. The last 3 years have not been normal. It's been something on the edge of disaster every time you turned around. I'm tired of presidents not acting like a president. I'm tired of presidents that get up in the middle of the night and go to tweeting and go to calling people vile names and acting like fools and staying 250 days at their golf resorts and acting like a king instead of a president. I like the Constitution. I like the balance of powers, and the separation of powers, more importantly, that we have in this country. I'm tired of the institutions of this country being under constant attack. I'm talking about the venerable institutions, the revered institutions, the Federal Bureau of Investigations, for instance. I'm tired of those things being attacked as crooked and dishonest when the attackers do so casually and with absolutely no proof whatsoever that anything like that is going on. And I can warn everyone listening to me tonight that Trump, one of the ways he won was not by raising his own poll numbers. He never did that. What he managed to do was so viciously attack his opponent that he brought her poll numbers down to his level before everything was equalized. And believe me, that is exactly what he is going to try to do again. So I do think it really does matter who we nominate, if for no other reason, that reason. Now, about a couple of the candidates that are running. Go ahead.
I'm tired of all the things that you just said, but the other thing that is really troubling to me is the people that he has appointed and chosen to lead in very important ways. You know, in our history, we have always turned to both business, higher education, nonprofits, all kinds of different organizations and companies to provide leadership in our previous administrations, whether it's college professors or corporate leaders. And that has provided a very diverse, sometimes, you know, contrary leadership, but it brought every voice, well, not every voice, but many voices to the table. But with President Trump, he's just, you know, looking for people who will agree with him. And I think one of the most important things that leaders, that good leaders do is recognize what their shortcomings are. And where they're not, mm-hmm. where they don't have as much knowledge, and filling in those gaps with really bright and innovative and thoughtful people. And I'm really that's probably the, among all the other things, that's also a huge disappointment for me, that we have mm-hmm. this, you know, government that's filled with shills for the rich, pretty much.
Yeah, well, you know, Roosevelt, in his time, had the Brain Trust, an administration full of what they call dollar-a-year men. Some of the top minds, some of the top business academic leaders, some of the top government leaders in this country that came forward, regardless of political affiliation, to help fight the Great Depression and help steer us through a world war. And now we have what I'd like to call the brain bust. we're talking people who are named to as department heads who have absolutely no experience doing this. Their most endearing feature, if they last, is just their blind loyalty to the president. We're talking about Jeff Sessions being by far the best of the three people that Donald Trump has named as Attorney General. Now, I want us to wrap our heads around what I said for just a minute. That's the kind of thing I'm talking about. And how many people has he appointed that had to go in no time? We're talking senior people over in the West Wing. that were named, and next thing you know, they're being indicted by Bob Mueller. You know, it just kept on and kept on and kept on and kept on, and it's really never gotten any better. The A-list people in the president's own party have stayed away from him. About the only thing he's gotten plenty of, and he's had to pay them well, is lawyers. Because everybody in that whole administration has had to lawyer up. But back for a moment to the people that are running against him. One of them, you and I have quickly figured out that our friend David really does like Beto O'Rourke. And he is an impressive young man. He ran a great race down in Texas, a tough state, and he only lost by 3 points to a sitting senator in a state that hasn't elected a Democrat in a long time. And he's taken the plunge. He's running. And he's, you know, running along about third in the race right now, nearly 9%, not too bad. But he has done something kind of odd. He's taking, I guess, a big gamble. He is pretty much avoiding television as a means of getting his message out, mass media advertising. And instead, he is actually putting his boots on the ground. I think he's already kept a promise to visit every county in Iowa. He's going all over the place, meeting groups of people, small and large, shaking hands. And I was wondering if you thought that was a good idea, Catherine. You know, you and I both worked in some campaigns, and you know, mass media was always not the main thing in the campaigns, but it's always a part of it. So far, he has shied away from that and gone to almost the old-fashioned hand-clasping politics of 100 years ago to try to get his message out and to win. Do you think that's a good idea?
Well, I haven't studied all these things, but I do believe that with the you know, increased popularity of streaming services and cable TV and, you know, DVRs and all these things, that people tend to not watch commercials anymore. I mean, I DVR almost all the shows that I want to watch, and then I start watching them 15 minutes in and fast forward through the commercial, and I'm done at the, you know, at the appointed time. Or I wait and watch them, you know, the next day or whatever. So I think there are many fewer eyeballs on television commercial breaks than there were, I mean, even 4 years ago, but certainly like 15 years ago. So I think there's some validity because of that sort of change in viewing behavior. I wonder. I haven't read as much about this maybe as others have, but I wonder if he's going to be doing social media advertising, which can be very effective and very targeted. Mm-hmm. So you can target a zip code, you can target a metropolitan area, you can target an age, you know, there's all kinds. I mean, we know that Facebook and Twitter and Instagram, they've all got all kinds of metrics that you can use. And we know that can be used for bad as well. And we understand that. So I wonder if, I mean, I believe in retail politics. Like, I think that there's almost nothing better than to meet a candidate. But it's not possible for everyone in the country to meet a presidential candidate. So I think the next best thing, in my opinion, the next best thing is someone who you trust, whether it's your coworker or your brother or or your mother-in-law or your neighbor or your child's, you know, your child's friend's parents or whoever, someone that you trust, to ask you to consider voting for a candidate. It's always been effective for me whenever I've, you know, I have a group of friends who, if I don't know what to do in a certain election, though, I do admit that I usually am pretty well prepared. I have a group of friends who I can call on and say, do you know any of these candidates? Do you have a, and so I think that more than, like, I've never really thought that, you know, endorsements of unknown, you know, someone that I don't know, like, why do I care who would I say? Like, what? I mean, obviously, there's some people who are very trustworthy, like Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton, and there's people on the right who are, you know, very trustworthy for them. But in general, like, large endorsements from relatively unknown political leaders don't really have an impact on me as much as someone who I know and trust and who knows what's important to me will say, yeah, I think this can, I'd like you to take a look at them. I think that's very powerful. So I think if he can build a grassroots movement that that gives him surrogates in places around the country who understand who he's talked to, who know him, that can then, you know, bring their friends in. And I think that was one of the things that Bernie Sanders did pretty well in 2016. I think he was good at that, of, you know, getting people to speak for him.
Well, so, funny you should mention Bernie Sanders. A little story came out that Jim Messina, who ran president's reelection campaign in 2012, was interviewed. And he pops up and says that Bernie Sanders cannot beat Donald Trump. He says that Trump will hammer Sanders with an economic message. I guess his point is that he feels perhaps that Senator Sanders' economic message is a little bit too liberal for general election voters. I guess that's where he's going with it. The polls right now show that Sanders would lose by 4 points to Trump, so it's close. And I also want to mention here that Messina most likely will be a strong supporter of Joe Biden, who right now is Bernie Sanders' chief opposition, probably, according to the polls, for the nomination itself. But we have to look at this. We have to wonder, okay, can Bernie Sanders defeat Donald Trump? Because I am here to tell everyone out there tonight that I believe that Bernie Sanders has a very, very devoted group of supporters who are going to be right with him from day one, most of whom were right with him 3 years ago. That's fine. If he's the nominee, I'll gladly vote for him, or any of the other candidates, I might add. I'm not going to say right now which one I'm going to be supporting, but we have to begin to think of this question. Can a democratic socialist defeat Donald Trump in the presidential race? Do you think that Bernie Sanders could defeat Donald Trump, Catherine?
I think that it's possible. I'm not going to say it's not possible. I think that I believe that the biggest challenge, well, I'm not going to say the biggest, a big challenge is going to be the supporters that he has speaking, if they're going to act, you know, if some of them are going to act as surrogates, it's really important when you're talking to voters who may not agree with you to find a place where you can, where you have common ground and talk to them in that space. So you can't walk into a, you know, you can't walk into a union hall and talk about getting rid of unions because they, you know, for whatever reason. You can't walk into a senior citizen housing project and talk about getting rid of Social Security and replacing it with something else. So my fear is that that the people who might be representing Bernie Sanders are going to be very forceful on the issues that Bernie Sanders is passionate about, but not in a way that reaches some of the voters who may not all there yet. You know what I mean? So, and I think that, and that's always a challenge for us, right? When I was, you know, when I've supported presidential candidates in the past, in the general, not in the primary, and I've talked to people who I know are on the fence, so I don't know very many people like that. It's always been important to me to find out what it is that they're worried about. What are the matters that concern them? And then find the talking points for the candidate that I'm supporting that meet those needs instead of just, you know. And I think we all make this mistake. We may, I think it was a big message mistake on the Affordable Care Act. I think we've talked about that on the show before. So I think it's very, and it's very difficult. It requires a great deal of discipline because oftentimes the candidate that we support, we do believe everything they believe, but that doesn't mean that every voter is like us. So that I believe is a,
so
is a big challenge.
Yeah, and so I want to make one more point, and then we're going to leave this subject and move over and spend the rest of the show talking about the Mueller report. And it's about endorsements. I was thinking about that when you said that. There's one group of people, and I'm going to say this is true like 100 of 100 times, that if they endorse somebody, I listen, I know exactly what I'm going to do. And that's the Duck Dynasty, guys. When they endorse a candidate in every situation, I heartily vote for their opponent. So that being said, we'll move over and talk a bit about the Mueller report. Yeah, there we go. We're going to talk about the Mueller report. I've read, let me start off by saying I'm reading the thing. And I've been carefully reading, so I'm taking my time a little bit since it's come out. I've read 150 pages of the 448 pages so far. Let me clue everybody in America in on one thing. Paul Manafort was like the most guilty person you would ever want. I mean, this dude was like a gangster or something, and he was all about the money. Literally would sell his soul for it to the Ukrainians, the Russians, the Ukrainians that supported Russians, and about anybody else that had $10 to pay him for whatever he wanted to do, because this guy had a high lifestyle. And it is pretty odd, by the way, to find a person who has, you know, been found guilty. And so he decides to cooperate with the authorities to lessen that blow. And then he lies to the authorities again and so has to have the proverbial book thrown at him. But the Mueller report, anyway, has been released. It had some rather iffy things in it. Some very sobering things, a very unflattering portrait of the White House was spread out. We learned some things. For instance, one thing we learned that I wanted to talk to our guest about, if he had been able to be with us tonight, was the fact that from what I've read and from what I've heard said to boot, the mainstream media, the stories that they, the investigative stories that they had out there in the last 22 months have pretty much turned out to be true. So this nonsense about screaming, screaming about the fake news, that got debunked in this report. Another very sobering thing, and I think the thing that's really going to be the focus of this going forward, it was actually two things. First of all, we talked about this before we went on the air, Catherine, and that's the redactions in this thing. Now, the Attorney General had said it was slightly redacted. I'd like to know what he thinks heavily redacted is. I was turning past whole pages that were blacked out, everything on the page, a lot of pages, especially at nonsense about both Stone and the Russians, just blacked out, blacked out, blacked out, blacked out, blacked out, blacked out. I remember reading the Watergate stuff back in the 70s, and mostly what was blacked out there would be like when Nixon would hurl some vile expletive out, which he was known to do. But this is just, national security, this and that and the other, and ongoing investigations, and la-di-da-di-da, and I know there's still 14 of those going on. That was one thing. All the redactions in this thing, so many, as a matter of fact, that it could literally change the meaning of what you were reading if all those blacked out areas were not blacked out at all. And so we have to think about that. And the other thing, obviously, is Bob Mueller did lay out a pretty compelling case for obstruction. And he just listed the areas off. And he said, you know, clearly that he would have loved to have cleared the president of obstruction. But he said he couldn't do that. And basically, he set it up for Congress to make the next move. And so then we have to start thinking about what is the next move. I mean, are we talking about Congress having impeachment hearings, some other kind of hearings? Are we talking about Bob Mueller and Attorney General Barr publicly being in these hearings? I got to ask you this, Catherine. What is the better course? Is it better for Congress to, I guess you'd have to say, do their constitutional duty if they feel that has committed crimes? Or is it better to let the American people make that judgment for themselves at the polls next November? So there's a legal question on the board here, and there's a political question. And don't you think that kind of leaves the Democrats, I don't know, walking a bit of a tightrope?
Yeah, so I haven't read any of it yet, but I've been watching the news. I watched Meet the Press this morning, and Rudolph Giuliani was on for way too long. And the chairman of the Judicial Committee, what the heck's his name? The House Judiciary Committee. Anyway, I think
Schiff?
The first thing. No,
you either
not
saw
Schiff.
Adam Schiff or Jerry Nadler, perhaps. Or,
yeah, Nadler. Nadler was on.
Okay.
I like Jerry Nadler a lot. I really appreciated his sort of straightforward approach to some of the matters that have come up over the last few months. I think the next step has to be an unredacted version provided to Congress.
Yep.
And then I think they need to analyze that, spend whatever time they need to read it thoroughly and understand it. And then I think they need to just decide, are we going to impeach or not?
Mm-hmm.
And now impeachment doesn't, you know, it's just like, I think on the news this morning, they said it's sort of the political equivalent to an indictment. It doesn't mean that he's going to be convicted of impeachment. It's just it creates a continue the investigation. So and the inquiry, I guess the inquiry is a better word. So I think, but I don't see why. Like this, it's a, you know, 400 plus page report. And if they can get that unredacted version, then I don't see why we need to talk to Bob Mueller. Why does he need to testify? Unless there's some questions that come up in the analysis of the report. But it seems to me that, okay, it's time to, like, you know, either get on the bus or get off the bus. Like, read the report and make a decision. I feel like if we take this much further, it's gonna mess up the whole election process for 2020. I mean, obviously, if they move to impeach, that's gonna be a long process that will be involved during that. But I just feel like this long vamp. Are we not going to? What's the next step? I think the next step: analyze the report and make a decision. Decide what you're going to do and then do it. And then let's, you know, either move on without an impeachment or move on with an impeachment.
Mm-hmm. Now,
I want to say one more thing. There's also like 12 or 14 investigations that we don't know who's being investigated. So that's sort of another piece of it. Like, we don't know who those people are or what those matters involve. So that's another piece of it that needs to be determined.
As a matter of fact, at the end of the report, there were 14 such investigations listed, and 12 were indeed blacked out. I assume some of it might have something to do with Stone, you know, who is about to get his day or days in court, and some other things, and we just don't know what those things are, because as we know, the feds did turn over some of these cases to the state of New York, the state of Virginia, the state of Maryland, I think, that all three have cases. The Manhattan District Attorney's Office has some stuff going on, and we may not know what's going on for a while. I understand things like that being redacted, but whole pages of stuff being redacted. I was like reading today, and it said, "The president said," and then everything was black. I mean, come on, you know. I mean, it's almost like things. I'm sure they didn't, but it just almost looks like things were cherry picked. And speaking of cherry picked, I'm a little surprised at the attorney general. He always was an institutional guy. He always was a government man. He's got a lot of experience in government. But in both that little four-page letter he wrote to Congress when the Mueller report was released and his press conference that I'm sorry to say I sat there and watched in its entirety the other day, let's just say the words, in quote, positive spin on the proceedings does ring true. And I just really don't think that helped anything. I don't think it helped explain things. I certainly don't think that anybody thinks it covered anything up. And I don't think it helped the administration or anything else. That explains why Trump was hollering, almost clicking his heels the other day. I'm vindicated. I'm innocent. I'm free and clear. And you know, a couple of days later, he's calling the report a bunch of BS as people start reading it. You see, so
right,
I don't see where the Attorney General helped anything at all. And I want to say something about Mitt Romney. He gave a damning assessment of the administration after his. What he said was his viewing of the report. That's great, but I got to ask Mitt Romney, does that really matter? Because what are you going to do about it, Mitt? What are any of you people, Susan Collins was another, yakety, yakety, yakety. What are you people going to do about this? Are you just going to turn a blind eye while he continues to go on his merry way? Because that's part of the problem now. This guy thinks that he can do anything that he wants to do. And there's a lot of people that, frankly, do not have the courage to stand up and say, you know what, president or not, you can't do things like that. And I realize, speaking of my own party now, of course you're faced with a dilemma of doing what many would say would be the right thing, you know, moving towards some sort of sanctions for the president, as opposed to the obvious political risk. And I realize and appreciate that, but you know what? At the end of the day, I think you got to come down on the right side of the right thing to do, and politics
right.
be damned.
And
now,
I'm
that's
tired of everybody. Everybody keeps saying, what are the Democrats going to do about this report? Well, what are the Republicans going to do about this report? Why is it
right.
why is it only up to us as Democrats to try to, you know, analyze and then react to this report? I'm glad that Mitt Romney and Susan Collins are speaking out, but if there's an impeachment and it gets to the Senate, you think they're going to vote for it?
Nope.
No.
No.
So
I'm
especially tired of Susan Collins. She's like the biggest tease around.
Yeah.
I agree
with you totally on the first step to be taken, Catherine. We have to see an unredacted report. At least the chairs of those various committees in Congress should be allowed access to them without delay.
Of course they should.
Because the law says they can. And if we are a nation of laws, then let them see those. Then they at least will know what to do, because they're the people who are in the positions to call these hearings to decide whether or not to even have them. They can't make these decisions with half-baked info. They need this info.
Exactly.
But I got a feeling that they're going to drag their feet at the Justice Department about this, because I really believe now, I'm sorry to say it, but I believe Trump has got his loyalists now running the Justice Department. He didn't want America's top law enforcement lawyer person in charge of the Justice Department. He wanted his lawyer in charge
right.
Department. He wants the Justice Department's first priority to be, above all else, to protect Donald Trump. He believes that's
right.
what they should do. And I think he's finally got his personnel, and I think they're going to drag their feet about releasing this unredacted report, because all they promised to do is, yeah, we'll talk to the committee chose. No, 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 no talking. Release the report. It's time. If they want to move on and get by this, well, let's move on. Let's get this thing done. But I believe they're going to drag their feet. If there's bad news for the president in those redacted sections, I believe they're going to keep them as quiet as they can for as long as they can. And I think they're going to drag their feet, they hope, until after the next election. That's what I think, too.
That's what frightens me.
That being said, believe it or not, Catherine, we are already
past our...
We talked for an hour. We're sorry Matt Dow wasn't able to be with us tonight. We certainly hate that David wasn't able to be with us tonight, but we think we had a good show, and we'll be back with you folks next week. It's been the Kudzu Vibe.
Good night, y'all.
Good night.